The mighty oak tree is even mightier than you might think when it comes to supporting native species of insects and other animals. The milkweed is pretty mighty, too. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, the power of native plants. Doug Ptolemy is the author of Bringing Nature Home, How You Can Sustain Wildlife with Native Plants. This hour, we'll talk about the research he's done about the impact of non-native plants on our native insects and animal species. And it's our spring membership drive. We're asking you to make an investment in Iowa Public Radio. Go online at iowapublicradio.org. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. Growing beautiful ornamental plants, many of them imported from Asia, has been a mainstay of landscapers and hobby gardeners in this country for well over a century. Some of those beautiful plants have become destructive invasive species, but today we're learning that even the seemingly benign and beautiful ornamental plants we love can make an ugly impact on our environment. That's part of the message that entomologist Douglas Ptolemy shares in his book, Bringing Nature Home, How You Can Sustain Wildlife with Native Plants. He'll be speaking tomorrow evening at 7 p.m. at Kirkwood Community College in Cedar Rapids as part of a 25th anniversary celebration for Trees Forever. Hello, Doug.
Hello, Charity. How are you?
Good. Thank you so much for being here today. And thinking about where the plants we use in our landscape are from originally is a fairly recent phenomenon. And you yourself were once a big fan of planting exotic ornamentals, right?
That's true. Most of us think of plants as decorations, so it's natural that we choose plants, the most beautiful plants from all over the world. And what we've forgotten in that formula is what plants actually do in our landscapes. And it turns out they have many really important ecological roles. And that has become more important as time goes by because more and more of our landscapes are in the form of residential landscapes or corporate landscapes. And the rest is in agriculture. We have very little of our natural systems left. So we need to have these plants performing all the important ecological roles that they originally did before we took over the landscapes for human use.
Tell me when you had your epiphany. When did you realize that you didn't want to plant any more of these exotic imported plants?
Well, one of the most important things plants do is to capture the energy from the sun, and then that energy is passed on to other organisms. And that is what really creates and supports our food webs. So my epiphany came when we moved into our new house, and it was a piece of land that had been mowed for hay for many years and then was not mowed before we moved in. And what came into that space were all these invasive species. So we had the whole place looked like Sleeping Beauty's castle. It was just nothing but thorns and vines, and they were all from Asia. And I noticed that our local insects were not able to eat these plants. And that got me thinking about, well, if we're not making any insects, then we don't have any food for the birds, and entire food webs collapse. And I became so interested that I actually focused my research on that for the last 10 years to measure the real impact of using plants from outside of local food webs. And the impact turned out to be even greater than I thought it might be.
Well, and
my epiphany really was just walking around my yard.
And you mentioned noticing that the insects weren't feeding off these invasive species. And, of course, that's one of the things that makes ornamentals very attractive to a lot of gardeners, is that they're pest-resistant.
Exactly, yeah. That's one of the criteria we've looked for over the years, are plants that are pest-free. And they're very good at being pest-free, but that means they're not contributing to their local landscape. So if we just accept the notion that plants are only decorations, then that works really well. But of course, I'm not suggesting that we try to find plants that are going to be devastated by insects. What we're trying to do is rebuild functioning ecosystems in our yard. And if we choose productive native plants that support healthy insect herbivore populations, then we also attract all of the natural enemies that eat those insects. And that becomes an important part of the story because many of those natural enemies are the birds that we would like to have in our yards. We underestimate the number of insects is required to have breeding birds in our yards. We now have some data that shows to have a pair of breeding chickadees in your yard requires between 6,000 and 9,000 insects during a two-week period. So if they're eating, 9,000 insects in your yard, particularly caterpillars, those are not caterpillars that are going to be eating your plants. And we've done studies to show that there's actually no more damage in a primarily native landscape compared to one that is primarily built with plants from China. So it's a fear we have, but not one that's justified.
You mentioned that you have spent the last decade working to measure the real impact of using these kind of non-native plants in our landscaping. And I understand this is probably difficult to sum up, but can you sum up a little bit of what you've found?
We've done a number of studies to demonstrate how much plants from outside of local food webs actually reduce insect populations. And a typical figure is around 22-fold. So if I'm looking at caterpillars in a yard where there are largely non-native plants, there's 22 times fewer caterpillars than in a yard where you've got good native plant communities. And that becomes important, again, if we get back to that breeding chickadee, because if you have 22 times fewer caterpillars, you don't have nearly enough to pull off reproduction. And if we landscape with plants from Asia all over the country, we have just eliminated reproduction in our bird populations. And 96% of our birds rear their young on insects. So that becomes a really important component of biodiversity. And, of course, they're not the only things that eat insects. All of our amphibians eat insects and our rodents and so many other things. So the bottom line is we cannot take insects out of local food webs without those food webs collapsing. And we see this all the time. When you look out your window, you typically don't see anything moving, and we think that's normal because it's been so long since we've seen anything moving that we think it's normal. And then we've labeled that good land stewardship. And now in many places of the country, if we landscape in a way where we see something moving, we might be fined by our civic association because it's a different type of landscape. There's more plants in it. So we need to embrace the fact that humans need functioning ecosystems, and functioning ecosystems don't happen without biodiversity, and we're not going to have biodiversity if we are using plants from someplace else.
I'm talking with Doug Ptolemy. He is the author of the book, Bringing Nature Home, How You Can Sustain Wildlife with Native Plants. And Doug, I think it's important to underscore, you're not just talking about the kind of imported plants that have become what we call invasive species. You're talking about ornamental plants that haven't spread like wildfire, but also just are not part of the natural ecosystem.
That's right. It doesn't matter whether a plant is invasive or not if we all plant it everywhere. And down south, crepe myrtle is a perfect example. It's actually the state tree of Texas, I believe, but it's from China, and it is planted so heavily all over the South that people actually think it is native because it's been here for so long. But it's not invasive at all. It doesn't spread. But, we put it everywhere. So that's the first trophic level wherever you are. It's these plants that we're planting, whether or not they're moving around on their own. And, the plants in a local space are the ones that are creating the energy for the food web in that space. So it doesn't matter whether those plants are moving.
Now, of course, I
will point out that 85% of our woody invasive plants in this country are escapees from our garden. So not all our exotics are invasive, but most of our invasives did start out as ornamental plants.
You mentioned looking out the window and not seeing anything moving in your yard. Well, when you look out the window of a lot of houses, what you see is a yard, a broad expanse of grass, Kentucky bluegrass or something like that. Are these monocultures also a big part of the problem?
Yeah, that's the second half of the problem. The first half is we don't use plants that are native to our ecosystems. The second half is we don't use enough plants. we've measured what landscapes, what suburban landscapes look like in Delaware and Pennsylvania and Maryland, and they're 92% lawn. So we have adopted these giant empty expanses of lawn at great cost, because we have to use a lot of energy to mow them, a lot of water to water them, a lot of fertilizer and pesticides to keep them weed-free. So these are costly landscapes that really are not much more than a status symbol. Lawn has become the status symbol for the wealthy. And even you don't have to be wealthy to adopt that status symbol and to fit in with the neighbors. So we've adopted it whole hog across the country. And the only thing that's really reversing that right now is our water shortages in the Southwest, where it's so irresponsible to try to grow a lawn in the desert that people are finally understanding that. We don't have the water to do that. And now in places like Tucson, Arizona, it actually is against the law to have a lawn because it is a poor use of our water.
So not only do we have these lawns, but of course, a lot of these lawns, if we want them to be as green and lush as we want them to be, we also need to use chemicals to make that happen. And so that just enhances the effect, right?
Exactly. And then it rains and those chemicals wash into our lakes and streams, into the Chesapeake Bay. And so there are serious consequences to changing our vast amounts of our country into these artificial landscapes. We have 45.6 million acres of lawn in this country, and that's increasing by 500 square miles of lawn every year. So there are better ways we can treat our landscapes.
Well, it's easy to say, okay, you know, I have a quarter of an acre lawn. Whatever I do with that isn't going to make a very big difference. So let's talk about some of the ways that just a small planting can really have an impact on the local ecosystem. And let's talk about one large oak tree. If you have one large oak tree in your yard, what kinds of insects, birds, other animals might be interacting with that, let's say in the spring?
All right. We have measured the caterpillar species that use oaks in the mid-Atlantic states. And it's 557 species of caterpillars, depending on oaks, for their growth and development. Now, if we remember that 96% of our birds are rearing their young on caterpillars, that's a lot of bird food right there. I tend to talk about insects as if they're bird food rather than insects, because then it's a lot more palatable, not just for us, but for the birds. So that's a really productive plant. As a matter of fact, oaks are the most productive plant that we have measured in this country. And there's, if you have room for a single tree in your yard, you cannot do better than by putting an oak in. And a lot of people have oaks, and if you notice, they're not defoliated. When do they get defoliated? They get defoliated when the gypsy moth comes through, or an insect from another land. And of course, I'm not promoting that, because those insects are here without their natural enemies to control them, so they get completely out of whack. But if we're talking about a diversity of insects from this country, you build a balanced food web in your yard that will attract the natural enemies that keep those creatures in check. And in the meantime, you have a beautiful oak. You've also created shade that will lower the temperature of your yard by 10 degrees. You've also put a plant in your yard that has a tremendous root system. So it's holding your topsoil. It's holding moisture after it rains. So you're stabilizing your watershed. You're preventing floods. You're sequestering carbon. Oaks are one of our very best carbon sequesters, and we need to be doing that. We need to be pulling carbon out of the air and putting it back into the trees that used to be covering the landscape. By some estimates, almost a third of the carbon that's now in the atmosphere has come from chopping down the forests all over the globe. So that oak becomes a really valuable producer of ecosystem services for humans.
I'm talking with Doug Ptolemy. He is the author of Bringing Nature Home, How You Can Sustain Wildlife with Native Plants. He's also professor and chair of entomology and wildlife ecology at the University of Delaware. And he's going to be in Iowa tomorrow evening at 7 p.m. speaking at Kirkwood Community College in Cedar Rapids as part of a 25th anniversary celebration for Trees Forever. We'll continue our conversation in a few minutes. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, I'm talking with Doug Ptolemy. He is the author of the book Bringing Home Nature, How You Can Sustain Wildlife with Native Plants. He's also professor and chair of entomology and wildlife ecology at the University of Delaware. And he's going to be speaking tomorrow night at 7 p.m. at Kirkwood Community College in Cedar Rapids as part of a 25th anniversary celebration for Trees Forever. We've been talking about how our love for ornamental plants, many of them imported from overseas, at least originally, has really damaged our local ecosystems all over the United States. And before we took our break, Doug, we were talking about how a single adult healthy oak tree can support so much diversity in a yard. But let's say I live in one of those suburban developments, a subdivision called Oak Knoll, but my oak tree is the only oak tree in the entire subdivision that has still survived. We talk a lot about the need for corridors for animals to be able to move from habitat to habitat. If I have this one habitat in my yard, does it still make an impact even if there's nothing else close?
Well, it is a start. Of course, the object is to get your neighbors to do the same thing. One single oak is not going to create a corridor that connects two isolated habitat fragments. But if you do have one oak and all your neighbors refuse to plant an oak, you still are providing stopover food for migrating birds. They're not going to breed there, but they're moving through your yard. They always go to the oaks first because they're the most productive. They have the most things to eat. So even that single oak is providing benefits. It will be a lot more effective if it gets some buddies in there. So for people who have small yards, they can't afford to plant a forest or there's not the room to plant a forest. Remember, you're connected to another yard, which is connected to another yard, which is connected to a public space in the center of town. Most of our human-dominated landscapes could benefit from putting a lot more plants into them. And you have to put plants that are appropriate to your ecosystem. So if you're in the east, that would be almost certainly a deciduous tree. But, you know, if you're in the Midwest, if you're in Iowa, prairie landscapes are really what wants to be there, unless you're in along a riparian corridor. So you have to embrace the biome in which you have chosen to live, because that's where the plants will do best, and the animals that live there are adapted to that particular biome.
Well, you mentioned a tree providing stopover food for migratory birds. And I'm sure there are a lot of people listening right now who have ornamentals in their yard that produce berries. And they think, well, I get a lot of birds in my yard eating these berries. And no, it's not a native species, but clearly I'm feeding birds. So is there anything wrong with that?
That's a really good question. The birds do love berries, and they really don't care where they come from. So, yes, you are feeding the birds while you have berries. But when you look at the berries on your tree, that's a few weeks of the year. The real question is, who's making more birds? And berries and seeds don't do that. Birds reproduce, I'll say it again, on those insects, on insect protein. So if you have plants that don't make insects but do make berries, you're not going to have the ability to make more birds, to have reproducing birds. So what you really need are plants that make berries and seeds and insects. And those are the native plants.
All right. So even though the birds might be eating your berries, it's a delicious snack, but it's not contributing to their long-term success.
It's part of their life history, but it's only one part. The big problem, most of our invasive woody plants are plants that make berries, like buckthorn. Everybody in the Midwest knows buckthorn, or bush honeysuckle that we have here in the east. And the reason they're invasive is because the birds eat the berries and then fly a mile away and poop it out in the woods. And then that becomes the entire understory of our woodlots. And that's the detrimental part. They have now displaced all the native plants that used to produce the insects that the birds needed to reproduce. And you've got these non-natives that make berries, but it doesn't satisfy the entire life cycle of the bird. So the bird ends up in trouble.
We've been talking a lot recently on Talk of Iowa and other news programs in Iowa about the plight of the monarch butterfly, because, of course, we're seeing the monarch at a population low that we have never seen before. And, of course, we used to see large flocks of monarchs in Iowa in the fall as they would gather for their migration to Mexico. And there's been a lot of talk about making sure that we plant milkweed so that we can support the monarch butterflies. Again, let's say I have a yard in a subdivision and I want to plant a little butterfly garden and put some milkweed in there. How much of a difference does that make?
That makes a big difference. I actually have some numbers from a small garden, 15 by 15 foot garden here in the East. It was in a courtyard in the middle of the Department of Ag building in Dover, Delaware. And they were doing a study in this little garden. They were actually looking at native bees, so they put in a bunch of plants that flowered during the summer, and milkweed was one of them. But there were many other plants there, so this was not solid milkweed. And one of the people doing the study counted the number of monarchs that went from egg to adult in this little garden in the middle of Dover, Delaware, in one season, and it was 150.
Wow.
So monarchs are really good at finding these patches of milkweeds. And this is where, you know, the real reason we've lost our milkweeds is because we've adopted clean farming techniques with Roundup Ready corn and soybeans that don't permit any weeds in agricultural spaces. So this is where homeowners have to pick up the slack. That little milkweed patch in your yard becomes vital to the monarch's continued existence, at least the migrating portion. They're down to 3.6% of their former population. That's perilously low. So we need to take advantage of our roadsides, any of our natural areas, get those milkweeds back. And it really, most of the burden, unfortunately, is going to fall on you folks in the Midwest, because that is the monarch breadbasket. That produces the millions of monarchs that would then migrate to Mexico to overwinter. We're working out of here in the East as well, and people plant milkweeds, and they say, I don't see any monarchs. And I said, that's right, because there's not enough to make it up this far anymore. So we need to generate them in the Midwest again and get those populations large and healthy.
And I think, you know, a lot of us in Iowa grew up and you still see milkweed in the ditches along country roads. But there are a number of different kinds of milkweed plants that are beneficial to monarchs, right?
Monarchs will eat any of the milkweeds. That's right. The one that they're usually hitting early in the season is Asclepias. I'm having a senior moment, but common milkweed. And that is the one with the big leaves. It is the most common milkweed. But
right.
There's also swamp milkweed. There's butterfly weed, which is the small bushy one that has orange flowers.
Maybe a little prettier than the common milkweed.
It's often in ornamental gardens. That's right. That's right. But remember, monarchs need two kinds of plants. They need milkweed. And for reproduction, because they are host plant specialists, like 90% of the insects that are out there. But during their migration, they're not eating milkweeds anymore, and milkweeds aren't in flower in the fall. That's when they need late season flowering plants, asters, almost anything that flowers and makes nectar, because that's the fuel that gets them to Mexico. So we need the milkweeds when the monarchs are reproducing, and then later in the summer and fall when they're moving south, we need to have other flowering plants in our gardens.
I'm talking with Doug Ptolemy. He is the author of the book Bringing Nature Home, How You Can Sustain Wildlife with Native Plants. And Doug, we mentioned earlier that, you know, a lot of people plant certain ornamentals because they are, quote, pest resistant and insects don't particularly like them. Now, if I'm going to plant a 15 by 15 butterfly garden in my yard, I'm not just going to have butterflies there. I'm going to have a lot of other insects as well. Do you think that we need to just get more comfortable with being in close proximity to insects?
Well, yes, we do. You know, most people worry about the bees and wasps that come to their flowers because they think they're going to get stung. But they won't. You have to step on it or grab it in your hand to get a bee or wasp mad enough to sting you, unless you're close to the nest. But when these guys are out foraging, and that's what they're doing in your gardens, they're looking for nectar and pollen, that's their business. They're not trying to protect the nest, and you can brush up against them. They don't mind. It is very difficult to get stung by a foraging bee. So many of our fears are misplaced. about bees or other things that might be in our garden. And, you know, I guess a lot of people do have a natural ick factor when it comes to bugs. It's funny, I hear this all the time from people trying to save the monarch. They say, I plant milkweed in my yard, but then worms got on it, so I squished them. Well, those worms are the larval monarchs, and that's the problem. We have such an aversion to insects in general that our first reaction is to kill anything we see. We need to get past that, because insects are vital to human survival. We can be that strong about it. We're not going to exist on this planet if we continue to kill all the insects. So they're part of healthy ecosystems. If you see insects in your yard, you're doing something right. You should celebrate that rather than grab the spray can.
Now, we talked about the lack of biodiversity in what we consider to be a beautiful lawn in our culture. And you also mentioned the way we farm today. So, of course, here in Iowa, not only do we have beautiful green lawns often, but then we have big fields of monocultures. We've got big fields of corn and big fields of soybeans. Why do we need to care about having these large monocultures? Why is that something that should concern us?
Well, when you add up all of that space, it's actually tens of thousands of square miles of corn and soybeans, where we're making corn and soybeans. But that area used to make a whole lot of different plants. It used to have, so even in our old farming techniques, and it wasn't that long ago, we made corn and we made soybeans, but we also made all those things we call weeds, most of which were flowering plants, which supported our native bee populations. We have 4,000 species of native bees. They're doing much of the pollination that happens out there. And before we imported the honeybee, they did all of it. Well, all of those things disappear when you get rid of those weeds. All of the seeds that support overwintering birds disappear. All of the rodents that support our hawks. And the entire food web disappears when you eliminate the plants that are the basis of these food webs. So, yes, we have to make corn and soybeans, and we can make them in clean ways, but all of those edges where it's not reducing yield at all to have weeds, we need to have replace healthy ecosystems with the plants that want to be there. It should become standard farming practices to have balance in the landscape.
All right, let's say I'm listening, I'm convinced, I've got a nice green lawn, I want to do something to change it. How do I get started?
Well, I always talk about reducing the area that's in lawn. A lot of people hear me talk and they say, I'm going to go home and rip out all my lawn. Nope, I don't suggest you do that because then you've got a big non-lawn and you have to right away think of something to put in there. If you reduce the area, and I talk about reducing the area by half, that might seem a lot to some people, but we could create a new national park. If we if there's 40 million acres of lawn and we took half of it out of lawn and put it into healthy plant production, that's 20 million acres. And if that's larger by far than all of our major national parks added up together. So we could have the largest national park in the country. And since we're going to do it at home, I always talk about calling it homegrown national park. And it could be the home to much of our biodiversity. We now are, you know, our cities and suburbs and the urban matrix is spread over so much of the landscape that isn't agriculture, that is where biodiversity needs to survive in the future. So this homegrown national park concept really is a powerful conservation opportunity that we have not been taking advantage of in the past, because we haven't thought we needed to. We thought that nature was happy someplace else. It really isn't happy someplace else. So let's put it right where it used to be, where we live, and then we can live together. The old concept of humans are here and nature someplace else just doesn't apply anymore. There's no need for us to look at it that way. Let's live together. And if we do, it's enormously rewarding. To walk outside and see these living things, not to everybody, but to so many people, is exciting. It's fun. It's educational. It's a great way to expose our kids to nature. They don't have to go on a field trip. All they have to do is step out their back door. It's a rewarding way to live. And I can tell you from personal experience, because that's exactly what we've done at our house. And it's just a fun place to be.
Let's talk about some individual kinds of trees or plants. So we already talked about oak trees and what an incredible impact one healthy oak tree can have. And we talked about milkweed. In your book, you go through and you talk about a lot of individual kinds of plants and trees. Can you give me some examples of things where you started looking into the far-reaching effects of having a healthy stand of this or a healthy one of these, and talk about some of the impacts that these different kinds of species of plants have?
Okay, we have actually ranked their importance in terms of their ability to support food webs, and oaks are number one. Number two are native prunus, so things like black cherry or pin cherry or American plum. That's an extremely productive genus that ought to be in our landscapes, depending on where we are. Number three are native willows. So if you're along a creek and you can have black willow or some of the other important species of willows that belong in your area, that's a very important plant. Then we get into our poplars. As you move further west, cottonwood becomes an enormously important plant along riparian corridors. Birches are really important. Some of our other hardwoods are hickories, are walnuts. Those are all really productive plants. If we move into the shrub later, our native viburnums are really productive. They support 103 species of caterpillars, and there's a lot of species of viburnum depending on where you are. And many of our native dogwoods are really productive as well. Alternate leaf dogwood or gray dogwood support lots of insects. They also have, they support pollinators as well. Nice batches of flowers in the spring that are really great for pollinators. Our native hollies are excellent. They have tiny little flowers, but they're excellent for pollinators. Those native bees are all over those holly flowers in the spring. And then, of course, they make berries later on in the fall. So you actually have to think hard to come up with native plants that aren't really productive at some stage in their life cycle.
Now, even if we're planting native plants in our yards, we do have this cultural attraction to neatness. What do we need to think about as far as the full life cycle of a plant? And I mean, I know that a lot of insects and a lot of animals can really use a dead tree, for example, as part of their ecosystem. That can be very important. Do we need to try to shift our focus away from neatness and let some things die and rot on the ground?
ideally, yes. But there can be safety issues with leaving snags right next to your house. So, you have to use some common sense. But if there's an area in your property where you could actually have a dead tree in the back, that becomes the home for the nesting woodpeckers and so many other birds and insects depend on that tree until it actually falls down. We're losing our amphibians because we don't have any what we call coarse woody debris on the ground. The places where the salamanders hide under or the toads can hide. All of these creatures need high humidity, and when we remove all the dust from the ground, then humidity levels drop and those creatures disappear. At the same time, I do understand that people love neat. It's kind of it's our expression of the fact that we have conquered nature, we're in control, and we can still have neat lawns. We can still have neat yards. Using a native plant doesn't mean it has to be messy. You can use it formally. If I say we should cut our area of lawn in half, the lawn we keep should be manicured. It should be mowed. It's a what we call cue for care. It shows that this is an intentional landscape. Our lawn can become wide paths or swaths that guide us through the landscape so we can interact with the plants and animals that are there as opposed to just this barren wasteland. So it becomes functional. But because we're mowing it and it still is green, it still imparts that impression of neatness that really is typically enough to convince the neighbors that this is okay. Everybody's worried about reducing property values. If you abandon landscaping and just let the vines grow over your house and everything else, then there might be something to that. But that's not what we're talking about at all here. We're talking about simply using more plants and more productive plants in our yard in a tasteful way.
Now, clearly your message is that each one of us really can make a difference and have a significant impact on our local ecosystem. Let's say I take your advice and I start making some changes. What do you think I can start to see? What are some of the early signs that I could pick up on that this is actually working?
That's a great question. And I talk about this all the time because we have serious environmental problems. You know, we've got climate change, we've got all these things. And it's very difficult for one person to change behavior and actually see that anything has benefited from that. But with this approach, when you put productive native plants in your yard, say you put that oak in your yard, you can see the differences, and you can see them almost immediately, even when the oak is very young. Go out and start to lift up the leaves, look underneath. Look for the variable oak leaf caterpillar. Look for the southern oak daggerworm. There's hundreds of species using that particular tree. And the birds will come and eat them, so you get to see the birds foraging in your tree. They will nest. They'll make their little nests in the crotches of the young oak. Those oak leaves will fall to the ground in the fall. They become perfect mulch because they last so long. All of these things can become part of your daily routine, where you're actually enjoying the sequence of wildlife that comes to that particular oak over the course of the season. And you don't have to do that to have a very functional ecosystem in your yard. But if you do that, you get to appreciate nature in some of its greatest forms. The polyphemus moth is one of the giant silk moths that we have in this country. And it feeds on oak. It will form that cocoon on the oak. It'll hang there all winter. You can watch it emerge in the spring. You can watch the female attract the male and then fly around and lay her eggs and then watch the caterpillars develop. So there's metamorphosis right in your front yard. You can use that as an educational opportunity for your kids. All of this will happen in your yard if you put these plants in your yard.
Doug, thank you so much.
You're quite welcome.
Doug Ptolemy is the author of Bringing Nature Home, How You Can Sustain Wildlife with Native Plants. He'll be speaking tomorrow evening at 7 p.m. at Kirkwood Community College in Cedar Rapids. This is part of the 25th anniversary celebration for Trees Forever. This is Talk of Iowa.